this several years ago in Big Sky near a, that's a ski resort a couple hundred miles east of here. And, I mean, it was a conference, different topics, but it was at kind of a cross-country ski ranch that's used as a conference center. And, while taking a break, I went out into the lobby, and there was a young woman there who was at the conference, but she was just sitting out in the foyer of the building, and she looked very upset, anxious, just sitting there by herself. And I asked her, "What's up?" And she said, well, she had gone for a walk by herself up through the National Forest to take a break from the conference. And after a while, she realized that a mountain lion was sort of aware of her on the trail. And she turned around, and she was walking alone, and she turned around and walked back to the conference center with this lion sort of following her back to the center. And she wasn't a large person. So it's just one of the things we have to think about in the Northern Rockies that people in other regions don't have to think about so much, unless you're going to get mugged by a manatee or something in Florida. But I'm not a great outdoors person, neither is my wife. We dabble, but my wife was walking on a nature trail in right on the edge of Bozeman, the city where I live, a couple hundred miles east of here. Right at sunset, just in the kind of late summer, so it was almost full dark. She was alone again, and she had our large dog with her, this doofus Newfoundland that thinks he's, you know, tough, but my house cat could take him. And again, a mountain lion came out of the woods along the creek right on the edge of Bozeman and looked at my wife and our dog and luckily kind of went off into the thicket on the other side. So I hike alone. That's the way I like to hike, even though you're not supposed to hike alone in portions of the Northern Rockies that have these large predators. I hike alone in grizzly country several times a year, which is not advised. I make noise you're supposed to make noise to alert these large predators that you're there. I sing old rock and roll songs. So if you see me coming down the trail singing The Animals or The Kinks or something, that's why. I'm not deranged in that way anyway. Another kind of large predator we deal with here in the Northern Rockies are wolves, of course. The welfare of wolves in the Northern Rockies is tracked by people around the world. When something happens to wolves here, Europeans weigh in one way or another. And of course, the impacts of these animals are very real on the people who live here. The odds of getting injured by one physically is less than getting struck by lightning, but there are many other impacts on the people of the region and many other reasons why people here want large predators here. I absolutely want wolves and lions and bears here, and most people who live here do. So it's a question of working out these impacts and these politics. That's what our opening panel is about today. I'd like to introduce our panel moderator, Scott McMillian, who's a veteran journalist, covered these issues probably more than anyone else in Montana over the years, more than 15 years in daily newspaper work as an environmental reporter. He's the go-to guys on wolves and grizzlies and Yellowstone National Park. He's written a book where he collected the stories of people who were attacked by grizzly bears called The Mark of the Grizzly. It's a fascinating book, not an alarmist book, just carefully describing incidents and how to avoid them and really honoring the animals and the people at the same time. He's done public television journalism. He's senior editor of Montana Quarterly, and he writes regularly for the Nature Conservancy magazine now. He's an avid hunter. He recently got back from hunting alligators somewhere in the south. He's a river runner, horse rider. He's lived in Antarctica as well as New York City. He could tell you which one was more difficult. And His website shows him, has a photo of him showing him holding a sedated lynx in his arms. So, Scott.
Thanks, Ray. Welcome, everybody. I guess I don't know who to, I don't have to tell you who I am because Ray just did that. I guess we'll get started. We're gonna talk about wolves and grizzly bears and the Endangered Species Act, how that affects both those species and the human lives here. Humans have had a complicated relationship with wolves and grizzlies for a long time. It's not just white men. The native people had a complicated relationship as well, but it wasn't as predatory as ours. As soon as the pioneers hit the ground, they started killing them off. From an estimated population of 50,000 bears 200 years ago, the number fell to just a few hundred by the 1970s. Of 37 populations, 31 were wiped out. The war against the wolf was even more effective. By the 1920s, they'd been exterminated from the contiguous United States everywhere except Minnesota. In the 1970s, with the implementation of the Endangered Species Act, both wolves and grizzly bears were listed, and since then, they've rebounded to the point that federal wildlife managers say it's time to delist the species and give the states the authority to manage them. In most cases, this is going to mean a hunting season. As you're probably aware, that idea didn't meet universal acclaim. The delisting effort started a long series of string of litigation, and that's resulted in a sort of on-again, off-again protected status for the bear and the wolf. As of today, a federal judge has ruled that they are both fully protected. Meanwhile, grizzlies are expanding into places where they haven't been seen in decades as the bears spread out and seek new habitat. This often means conflict, which usually results in dead bears and sometimes dead people. Just this week, a healthy male bear was killed near Yellowstone because he developed an addiction to garbage. This summer, grizzly bears also killed two people near Yellowstone Park. The wolf population in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming is estimated at about 1,700 animals. That's more than five times the size of the original recovery goal. Most of them sprang from a few dozen wolves that were released in Yellowstone and central Idaho in 1995 and 96. Population growth averaged about 20% a year for most of that 15-year period. But as that population grew, so did impacts. Predation on livestock continues to grow, and wildlife managers blame wolves, at least in part, for huge drops in elk numbers in some regions. This results in angry ranchers, angry hunters, angry politicians, and it's my personal opinion that this anger could translate into big problems for the Endangered Species Act, which is one of our keystone environmental laws, and we'll try to get into that a little later. So I want to introduce our panel. Suzanne Stone, in the blue jacket, is the point woman on wolf issues for Defenders of Wildlife, which is the lead plaintiff in the efforts to make sure wolves retain full protection under the Endangered Species Act. Defenders has also developed compensation programs for ranchers who lose livestock to wolves and grizzly bears, and has helped ranchers implement non-lethal management techniques to protect their livestock. Tim Aldrich, at the end of the line, is president of the Montana Wildlife Federation. That's a group of hunters and fishermen that works hard to protect habitat for all kinds of critters, not just the huntable species. And the Wildlife Federation supports delisting of wolves and grizzly bears and allowing limited, reasonable hunting of these species, much like black bears and mountain lions. Elaine Allstead, to my left, is a rancher from Big Timber, Montana, and she works with many groups dealing with agricultural and wildlife issues. Her family ran sheep in the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness just north of Yellowstone until the appetites of protected predators and the complications of the Endangered Species Act made it impossible for that long tradition to continue. Dan Pletcher directs the wildlife biology program here at UM, where he does something akin to what environmental journalists do. Like us, he works in the nexus of sociology and biology, which can be a place with a lot of friction. He's worked around the world, but I'm hoping he'll shed some light on the difficulty and the maybe some possible solutions for managing magnificent but sometimes really inconvenient predators in a landscape that is dominated, after all, by the most efficient predator, us. I'm going to give everybody 2-3 minutes to introduce themselves. Elaine, you want to start? Okay.
I'm Elaine Alstead, a rancher from Big Timber, Montana. And I, like Ray, when I'm in the backcountry, sing. I sing Unsinkable Molly Brown and You Are My Sunshine. And it does work. Our family, we are a fourth-generation ranching family. My husband's father came over from Norway, immigrated from Norway, and started out with a homestead, and then it's just passed down through the generations. We, like Lawrence's father, ran our sheep in the backcountry in the wilderness area, like his relatives. My husband's father, his brothers all came over and did exactly the same thing. They were herders. They herded for other people, and then they homesteaded and started their own operations. In the country where we grazed, there used to be 30-some bands. And a band is like 1,200 ewes, and then all the lambs that that those ewes produce. And it just kind of, through the years, dwindled down because of predators, because of the economy, because of, you know, all sorts of reasons, to where just a few years ago, there was only 3 of us left. And the third of the 3 quit because I think of family ranching, had gotten down to where there was, you know, 4 kids in the family, and they were fighting over who was going to get the ranch. So they quit. And then there was 2 of us. And the second one, I believe, quit for kind of the same reasons. The son did not want to take over the sheep operation and run sheep in the backcountry. But us, being the stubborn Norwegians we are, decided we were going to stick it out for a lifetime, several generations. And I married in 1969. In 71, we bought the ranch from my husband's father, and it was glorious, just doing what we needed to do, lambing, calving, the whole thing about ranching, raising a family, and running sheep in the beautiful backcountry. Then about 1974, it started the Wilderness Act, and that was going to affect the rules and regulations of our grazing permit. So I figured I needed to get involved, be part of the decision-making, not be a victim, just, you know, be in there. And that's sort of what got me started in politics, I guess you'd call it. And the Wilderness Act was enacted in 75. And then from then on, our life has been constant meetings, constant hearings, constant rules, that bliss of just doing ranching was no longer there. And then the Endangered Species Act was the same thing. They had the hearings, the initial idea, initial idea, the hearings, rulemaking, and then we have to follow the rules that they made. And we couldn't protect our property, so we had to learn to such things as guard dogs, using guard dogs, using rubber bullets, using cracker shells, And living the life, I mean, we were used to predators, and my husband, his famous saying, which I say at every meeting, but it was so true, he said, you know, it doesn't bother me that they, you know, are introducing wolves. It's just one more predator. I'm awake anyways. I have to be awake for grizzly bears, coyotes, mountain lions. I'm going to be awake anyways. But little did he know the impact that they would have. We started losing sheep by, first it was just, you know, maybe 10, 20, 30, and then it got to be up to 100. We'd come home short 100. And so we just couldn't take the losses anymore. The defenders, for a while, reimbursed us for our losses, and then they got to where they said, we came out with 60 verified losses, and they said, you know, no, you have to do something. We have to do something different. And so we did. They purchased our permit, and we used that money to go buy a ranch in northern Montana. Okay. And if I could just have one more little comment. And that is now being affected the same way I was talking about that started in 1974, is the national grasslands. Little did we know the ranch that we bought up next to the Canadian border is now being looked at as a national grassland. So the fight goes on.
More meetings.
Yeah, more meetings. Okay, Suzanne,
yep.
You want to tell us a little about yourself and your group?
Yep, my name is Suzanne Stone. I work for Defenders of Wildlife. I've been working on the wolf issue here in the Northern Rockies since 1988. And was part of the U.S.-Canadian wolf reintroduction team. I was able to go to Canada and take part in helping to capture the wolves that were up there and bring them down for the reintroduction into central Idaho and into Yellowstone National Park. Since that time, I started working for Defenders and have been their point person on the wolf compensation program, which was established in the 1987 to reimburse ranchers for livestock losses as wolves were coming across the border actually on their own from Canada into northwestern Montana, which is where our program started. And then spread to Idaho and to Wyoming as the wolf population increased and spread and was reintroduced there. I also manage our program on the prevention, the non-lethal type of deterrence to help ranchers coexist with livestock and help them implement ways of defending their livestock from wolf predation. And I also sing when I'm in the backcountry or in the grizzly country. So it's nice to hear, but that's my song too, is You Are My Sunshine, so we have something in common. I think that one of the points that we were going to try to make today is that, you know, this is about finding the balance between wolves, grizzlies, and humans. And there's been an awful lot of energy invested in just the opposite of the fight. Our biggest concern with the wolf delisting plan, the federal plan for this region, wasn't the original recovery goals, it wasn't the state wolf management plans. It was the legislative plans, particularly in Idaho, where we have the core of the Northern Rockies wolf population. Most wolves in our region live in Idaho, about 800 of them. And they are the secure core for the greater meadow population of wolves here. And under our federal delisting plan, the moment that federal protections are lifted, the state of Idaho can take that wolf population from 800 wolves down to 100 wolves. And they can override their own Fish and Game Department to do that. And last year, as soon as federal protections were lifted, we had a bill in our state legislature saying that that's what they were going to do. So because wolves are managed so differently than other species and considered so differently, we know that that federal delisting plan has to be stronger, that you can't just allow the states to kill 1,200 out of the 1,700 wolves that we have here right now, which is the current plan. So our biggest concern is not keeping wolves on the Endangered Species Act forever. We don't want to do that. We'd like to see a good, strong wolf delisting plan for the regions. We want the states to take over their management, but to do so responsibly. In Idaho, for example, sounds like we have a lot of wolves, 800. We have 3,000 mountain lions. They eat twice as much elk as what wolves do. We have 20,000 black bears. We have 100,000 elk, hundreds of thousands of deer. So we would like to see more than 100 wolves in the state, because we know at that level that that wolf population is not sustainable and it's not viable. Now, we've been calling for bringing the stakeholders together for over two administrations now. We applauded Montana for doing that. They actually brought the stakeholders together to craft their plan. It was the only state in our region that did that. No one else has allowed us to work together as stakeholders to reconcile some of the conflicts. So we're hoping that that will occur for our region, and we can work together here to craft a good delisting plan that will meet the needs of the people that live here, as well as the recovery needs for wolves here in the region. Thank you.
Dan?
I'm Dan Pletcher. As Scott said, I'm the director of the Wildlife Biology Program here at the University of Montana. I've been at the University of Montana since 1984. Prior to that, right after I finished my bachelor's degree at the University of Minnesota, I had the opportunity to work on wolves and moose up on Isle Royale. Some of you are familiar with that location. It's in Michigan. Every wildlife biologist dreamed to work on large carnivores, and I got some of that very early on in my career. After I got done with graduate school, I arrived here on campus, and Bob Ream, who is now a retired faculty member, lives in Helena, was starting a wolf project, and he came up to me, introduced himself, and said, we're starting to have some wolves here in Montana. I'm doing most of the wolf work, but we really want to get some studies going on impacts of wolves on their prey. Are you interested? And I had to say, well, I'm going to have to think about that for a while. Yes. And jumped all over it. So from about 1984 until the late 1990s, we did the early wolf research in and around Glacier National Park. And as Suzanne mentioned, but a lot of people aren't aware, wolves first came back to this region on their own. They dispersed through genetics, we think, from Banff and Jasper. They came here from Canada. Most of the early population growth was back towards Canada. That's just the way wolves disperse. They're looking for a mate, usually food. And where they find other wolves is where wolves have been traveling. So most of the dispersal early on was there. Since the late 1990s, I've had a few graduate students working here in Montana on wolves, in Italy on wolves, in the Alps. Somebody's got to do that kind of stuff, supervise. But I've also increasingly gotten very frustrated with what's happened with wolves in the Northern Rocky Mountains. We've got a situation where we should be celebrating success, and we're not. And in some ways, we're in a worse situation than we were 10 or 15 years ago in terms of the public's approval of what's going on. We had broad agreement to reintroduce wolves into Yellowstone and central Idaho. The public signed on to that idea, agreed to it. We're now 6 or 7 times that many wolves. They're still not delisted. There are good reasons that they're not delisted, and I hope we get a chance to talk about some of that. But I hope we also get a chance to talk about how to move the process forward.
Tim, please.
Thank you. I'm Tim Aldrich. I'm in the third year of my one-year sentence as the president of the Montana Wildlife Federation. And I'm enjoying every moment of it, and I think the wolves are certainly adding to that. I'm a native of Missoula, Montana, born and raised right here. Went to this institution and graduated in zoology way before most of you were born. But anyway, I've been a hunter and angler nearly all of my life. As soon as I was able to follow my father through the woods around this country, I was there. And I have great respect for our wildlife resource, all of them. Doesn't make any difference to me where they are on the food chain. They're part of what belongs here, and we need to take care of them and do it right. And I think I represent the Montana Wildlife Federation when I say that. I think that my many travels in the woods, and I've done a lot of things in the woods. I've hunted, I've hiked, I've fished. I fought fire for a number of years, and woodland, wildland fires and so forth. I think my experiences are enhanced by the fact that we have these large predators out there. It's somewhat humbling for we humans to realize, you know, that we're not the biggest guy on the block sometimes. And I think when you go to the woods in the Bob Marshall or the Glacier Park or Yellowstone Park or the Madison Valley, Yellowstone Valley, Gallup, you're not it. I mean, I think if you don't have your head on a swivel at times, you know, you're just you're fooling yourself, because they're there, and you need to be prepared, you know, in a way to do that. But I think it enhances that experience of being in this country. It's part of the value that I appreciate for what we have in this part of the world. The issues over the gray wolf are probably the most passionate things that I've seen in my experience in Montana relative to wildlife management. And maybe that's very appropriate. You know, as I look back over history, you know, you look at the Lewis and Clark travels through this country, and the abundance of wildlife, the numerous species, and the great populations of bison, and their encounters with grizzly bears. And I mean, it was an amazing story. But, you know, by the 1880s, we were basically without that resource. The homesteaders, the miners, the railroads, the people subsisting and the market hunting, they'd taken care of that amazing resource. And I think we spent 130 years bringing that resource back to where it is today. And it's a marvelous journey as far as I'm concerned, and it follows a course that I refer to as a North American model for wildlife conservation. And the hunter-angler community has been extremely important in that whole venture, that 130-year period, from the initiative that they showed, from the discipline they showed, from the understanding that they needed to put rules in place and they needed to enforce those rules and we needed professional management and so forth, that we needed to expand the habitat that had already been broken up in so many ways by the homesteading and the mining and the railroads. Millions of acres have been put under protection and preserved and are there today for wildlife management and for us to enjoy, you know, for wildlife habitat, with the dollars and efforts of sportsmen through their license fees, through acts like the Pittman-Robertson Act, an excise tax on guns and ammunition and so forth. So the hunters have a real stake in what's going on, and they're ready to delist. As Dan Pletcher says, you know, we're there biologically, we're not there sociologically. That balance, you know, understanding how we're going to deal with the wildlife population in some areas that are truly being adversely affected. How we're going to deal with the ranchers, the livestock people, how we're going to keep the ranchers and farmers on those family farms and ranches that provide so much of our wildlife habitat in this state of Montana. So the issues are huge here, you know, and it's time, as far as we're concerned, to delist, put the wolves under that management scheme of the North American model, and consider them amongst all the other animals. There's got to be a balance between all of them, along with a lot of social things that just simply are not there today. So I'm happy to be here today. I think it's a great opportunity to discuss this, so thanks.
Okay, thanks, everybody. A couple of good points already. I've observed, at least in wildlife management, I think, as a nation, we're kind of like a bad poker player. We don't know how to deal with success. And with some of these remarkable recoveries that we've had in wildlife management, Yellowstone bison comes to mind, we have a hard time dealing with the fruits of our success. We recover a species and then don't know quite how to proceed from there. I guess with that point, there's a lot of disagreement over just how, you know, how many wolves have to be out there and where. Suzanne, how many wolves is enough? You say 100 is not enough in Idaho.
Right.
I think you probably get pretty broad agreement on that, but how many is enough?
Well, I think that's a question for the science community, and it's something that we've been asking for from the Fish and Wildlife Service for a long time, to conduct a review of the most available current science. Right now, the recovery goals are based on science that dates back to the 1980s that we know is inadequate. I've not had a single biologist, especially a wildlife population scientist, that has defended that 100 wolves in one core subpopulation is enough, that we have to have more than that. And we're not asking for thousands of wolves. We're not asking for keeping the wolves on the Endangered Species Act forever. And I'm not sure that there's a magic number. I think there's a possibility that you could have 2,000 wolves in this region and manage them badly so that there was a disconnect, and that you could have 1,200 and manage them better so that there's connectivity between those populations and that they're ecologically functioning. But it's a multi-layer answer there. You know, it's how they're managed, how the population is connected, and those things have to factor into it. My guess is that the managers are going to come back eventually and tell us that it's going to be some type of sliding scale, that they're going to be looking at population fluctuations in wolves just like they do elk, deer, moose, bear, mountain lions, and others. But for us to try to manage this population down to the very, very minimum is not sustainable.
Dan, did you you raising your finger there?
Yeah. There's a lot of disagreement on how many is enough, but the one thing that I would ask people to consider, and Suzanne mentioned it, and it's extremely important with all species, is connectivity. The one of the wolves that we radio collared in Glacier National Park dispersed over 500 miles in the middle of the winter along the Continental Divide to northern British Columbia. They disperse great distances, very unlike grizzly bears that don't. So the wolves that we have here in Idaho, Montana, Wyoming are connected to all the wolves in Canada, Alaska. So the genetic issues that you would have if you had a truly isolated population, and in that case 100 is most certainly not enough, aren't as big a deal with wolves as they are for some because of their ability to disperse. Now, there are things that you can do to break that ability of a species down in terms of ability to disperse, and as we continue to develop, those could increase. One of my biggest fears is that development continues to increase throughout the western part of Montana, and those of you who are from the east think, holy cow, what the heck are you talking about? But these 10-acre ranchettes, they're no more happy when their pet dog or horse gets killed or run by a wolf than someone who's raising sheep. They're upset too. And the best thing that we have on these lands is to keep them open, keep ranchers there. They don't typically make very much money, ranchers don't, but their land is worth a fortune. And when they sell it, what happens to it? It goes to a gated community, it goes to condos, it goes to golf courses, it goes to taking a big property, putting 10 trophy homes on it, 20 trophy homes on it. None of those people want their dogs chased by wolves. It goes to trailer courts or middle-class housing developments. Any of those things are much worse for wolves and all other wildlife in Montana than having ranchers on the land.
Elaine? Excuse me, Elaine, you're a rancher. You've lived with these. How many wolves is too many?
Well, the problem I have is when we go through the process, they came up with the number, and then all of a sudden that's not enough. And we get above that goal, and it's still not enough. And I get to see the impact side of it. And I understand about, I've been to all these meetings. I've been a part of the process. And I understand the connectivity, but connectivity also affects rules and regulations on how ranchers manage their own land. And then we have the question, how much public land and regulations is enough? Because you're driving the old-time ranchers away also. So there's that balance.
So it sounds like there's two issues that ranchers are dealing with. There's the impacts of the wolves, and then there's the impacts of the regulations that come
land
with
use
wolves.
Regulations.
Yeah, land use regulations. How about for the hunting community? I mean, has MWF come up with, where would you like to see the wolf population at, realizing there's a lot of wiggle room for, you know, how it's managed. You know, in Idaho in particular, there's a lot of calls for people to go in and wipe out packs in certain areas because the elk population is down. Whether or not that's due to the wolves is you're not going to convince some people that it isn't. But there are these calls for that. How would you approach that, Tim?
Well, I think that, you know, the one thing we have to protect, and that is the biological sustainability of the populations. That's a given. We don't go beyond that point. And I don't know that the science is as perfect as we would like it to be and to allow us to put a number on that. I don't think it ever will be. I think that what I call and what is referred to as adaptive management, you know, where you incrementally make changes and then you stand back far enough to see what those changes are doing, you know, and then you adjust from there. And I think that best happens, you know, when we have one agency managing the whole array of wildlife, you know, on the landscape. And I think we probably all agree with that. The numbers thing, I think, is we focus too much there. I think where we are today, we certainly are there biologically in the state of Montana and the state of Idaho. And certainly the way we manage that over time is probably the variable that, you know, that we have to pay attention to. And I, you know, with the onus on the states, you know, for close supervision and oversight for 5 years after the delisting, you know, there's an ample period, you know, for that federal oversight over how well you're using this adaptive management scheme to protect the most important of the values. But it's most important that we get all those critters back under one umbrella, managed by one agency, where the people can work, and, you know, sociologically and biologically through that one agency.
But it sounds like you're saying that the with the wolf numbers we've got now, that's about enough.
I think you know, that we have room to play. I think, and I don't mean that, you know, as a laughable thing, but I think we definitely have room to try different things and see where it goes, not only with regard to the wolves, but with regard to the livestock industry and also with regard to the wildlife populations that in some areas are really catching heck.
With some management experiments, you mean?
I think that's the license we have to give our managers. They have it right now with adaptive management.
Dan's twitching his finger again.
I'm twitching my finger. I twitch a lot.
That's all right.
I just thought it might be helpful to let people know what these numbers are based on.
Right. Okay,
and most of it's genetics. And if you want to be 95% sure that this population is going to persist for 5 years, you need fewer animals than if you want to be 99% sure that you're not going to have genetic inbreeding problems for 1,000 years. Right? Does that make sense? So, say it again. I haven't had enough coffee. If you want to be 99% sure that wolves are going to be around for 1,000 years, you better have a lot of them out on the landscape. If you're comfortable with 95% sure for 50 years, you don't need as many out there on the landscape due to genetic inbreeding sorts of effects. So, you know, the sort of thing that Tim's talking about here with adaptive management is basically the way all wildlife management occurs today. They monitor populations every year. If they're higher than they want them, they reduce them. If they're lower than they want them, they try to increase them. That's just the way business is done. And we're not going to stop counting wolves. They're too hot a species.
The primary tool for managing other species has been hunters, especially when you want to reduce numbers of, say, elk or deer or any of the game animals. And if the populations are low, then people tend to restrict hunters. I mean, it's been a...
But it's also habitat.
I mean, also habitat,
the, awful lot of the work has been restoring habitat.
Yeah, but in the adaptive management schemes, to my understanding, well, hunting is one tool in the box. It's one that you can change from year to year as populations adjust. A lot of people have called for hunting seasons on wolves in the northern Rockies. There was a one-year season, nearly filled the quotas in both Idaho and Montana. A lot of wolves got shot. But also, every year, a lot of wolves get shot by government agents because they've been preying on livestock. It costs a lot of money to send these guys up in helicopters and hunt down misbehaving wolves. One argument is that, well, why not have hunters do that instead of, and then gather some license fees instead of spending tax money on that? Suzanne, is that a valid argument, as I've just put it? I mean, let hunters do the wolf control instead of sending wildlife services out there at great expense.
Well, there's a real big difference between wildlife services and what they do and hunters. Hunters are more opportunistic, so they're going to be looking at hunting animals that that they come across, that they encounter. Wildlife services is much more direct. They're looking for animals, for wolves that have actually attacked livestock. So they're rooting out the wolves that are causing the problems. So there's no discrimination on one side. There's, you know, a very focused removal on the other. So it doesn't have the same impact to the livestock community for certain. And what we've seen in areas where wolves have been hunted, especially on the boundaries of our core wolf population right now, I can give you a couple examples from Oregon. Wolves are making their way out of Idaho now, and they've just reestablished in Oregon. We have two breeding packs there. Our first depredations occurred last year on livestock. It was both sheep and cattle depredations, and it was by two teenage wolves that had been separated out from their pack. They didn't know how to hunt. Wolves really don't know how to hunt on their own very well until they're about 10 months of age. Even then, they're kind of amateurs for a while. So that was one case. The next time we had the same problem, that we had wolves in a pack that the juveniles separated away from the adults, and the juveniles were, again, the ones killing livestock. They're not as good at that age of killing wild game. So you can actually cause more problems than you resolve if you're not careful in how you manage the species. If you're going to use hunters as a tool, then you want to make sure that you're focusing on a time of year when wolves are more probably stable in their territory, that you're not just sending dispersers out across the range at the same time that there's livestock out there, because that's kind of a recipe for disaster. And if you look at what happened this last year, in fact, I was looking at the statistics. Wolves killed, if anybody has a calculator in the room, that would be really helpful, because my brain doesn't work that quick while I'm talking. In 2009, wolves killed 202 sheep in Montana, and that is the most amount of sheep ever recorded killed by wolves in a single year since they dispersed to the state from Canada in the 1980s. And we've had it. We've had headlines reading, wolves kill record number of sheep in Montana. In 2009, wolves killed 202 sheep in Montana that we know of, confirmed losses. The unconfirmed could be maybe up to four or five times higher than that. According to the National Agricultural Statistics Service, predators at large killed 15,000 sheep in Montana last year. Yes, wolves did kill sheep, and it makes the news. And it makes the news more than it does any other species killing sheep in our state. And I think because of that, the public comes away with thinking that wolves are the primary threat to livestock. In Montana, we had, 5,000 sheep last year that were killed by bad weather. Right. And those things don't make the news. So okay. I think when we're looking for balance, we've got to be talking about all the facts.
Well, no offense, Elaine, but I knew a guy who got out of the sheep business several years ago. I said, well, why? You've been doing it for generations. He said, I'd like to just be able to go to town, get drunk for a weekend, still be in business when I get home. I mean, sheep are often looking for a way to die, it seems like. We're going to go to questions here pretty quick, but I want to talk a little bit about grizzly bears before we move to questions. The bear populations are growing. I personally find that quite exciting, and the idea of them going out into the prairie. If you're familiar with the Montana geography, when Lewis and Clark came up the Missouri River, they first encountered grizzly bears right around the North Dakota border. And it scared the bejeebers out of them. They'd never seen critters like this. They talked about a lot of terrible fights and encounters with bears, but if you read the journals closely, the people picked most of those fights. They were looking for bears. They were a big source of nutritious fat for guys who were working real hard in tough conditions. Now bears are starting to move east along the Missouri. They've been spotted 200 miles east of the mountains. There were some this summer spotted out there, and I believe it was the very same day, and or maybe the day before, and I thought, wow, that's pretty exciting. The bears are going back to their native territory. And then the next day, I read about a man down in Cody who was killed by a bear. And maybe it's not quite so simple. It's been hard enough for those of us who live in bear country all year to adapt ourselves and learn to live with the bears and teach bears to live with us to some degree. And for it's a different culture out in the prairie. They don't have that institutional memory. And anyway, I'm digressing. But where do we see the focus of bears? I mean, they're protected right now, but there's food source threats, climate change. There's a lot of speculation on how that's going to affect bears. I don't know. Dan, you want to take a stab?
No. No, I'll take a stab. Carrying capacity. You're not going to have 10 grizzly bears in this room, obviously, right? But there's only so many bears that a place like the Bob Marshall Wilderness is going to hold. They're territorial. They get together, males and females. You all know what they do. But two males are going to fight. They're going to have separate territory. So you can only get so many in the Bob Marshall Wilderness. If your population is going to grow, it's not going to grow within that area. It's going to expand out. And so what has to happen is society has to decide, where is it acceptable to have these animals? And it's the same thing with wolves, and that's a lot of what we're fighting about. They're not going to have territory smaller than one where they can feed their pups and survive. So populations aren't going to continue going up in western Montana. And if you follow wolves, for example, in Yellowstone, their populations went like this, just on an incredible trajectory. But guess what? Now they've done this. And that's because the prey base is lower, and the habitat is saturated in that area with wolves. We have the same thing with grizzly bears going on as with wolves.
So does that mean we're all going to have to sing You Are My Sunshine wherever we go?
Well, one of the reasons Ray Ring hikes alone is because of his singing ability.
Yeah, well, nobody will go with Ray, not if he's singing. I know that. Elaine, you've got a lot of experience with bears as well as wolves. You don't have any yet up on the border, but you might.
Yes, we do. Actually, they're coming down the drainages toward Big Timber. They've had like 3 sightings this summer,
mm-hmm.
and down into livestock ranches, populations, campgrounds. The population is where they're pushing out into toward the Yellowstone.
Any predictions, desires on where you'd like to see grizzly bears? My wife loves to ride horses in the backcountry, and she kind of thinks they ought to all stay in the park, all the bears, because she doesn't like to hear me sing either.
I think there's an acceptable place for grizzlies, and if I was involved with the delisting of the grizzly, they got to an acceptable population, according to science, and it took 12 years to delist the grizzly bear, and now they're back on the list. So I have a huge frustration with the process.
Similar to what you've experienced with a lot of government programs.
Yeah. And so for those 12 years, grizzlies increased to probably the balance that they are going to be unless there is more resource added to it. So we have to decide, is enough enough? Because when they start coming out into ranching country, campgrounds, close to populations, they're going to be in trouble. So I believe we need to face the fact. And connectivity has been, I bring that up again, how are you going to connect those populations? Okay. Some of the terrain is there; it's not there.
Tim?
Well, I'm just simply amazed, I guess, that with the technology that we've developed as far as better understanding bear populations and you know, through using DNA and some basic wire and a few scent things, we know a lot more about how many bear we have. But I think we also realize more and more that as they try to disperse, they don't find everything they need, you know, mm-hmm. that's acceptable with the human population, you know, when they get there. And that example this year out there in the prairies, you know, east of the Rocky Mountain front, you know, a great example. Up in just very close to home here up on the Flathead Indian Reservation, they had all kinds of bear problems up there. They had a sow grizzly, I think, and cubs that chose chicken houses as their outlet, you know, for seeking food and maybe a little entertainment. But, it, you know, it's not comical. I mean, it really helps define, I guess, socially, you know, what's acceptable as far as the range that grizzly bears can exist in. And I think they need to be delisted again. I don't think it hurts them. I think any hunting that would take place would be very, very, very controlled, and I just don't see it getting out of hand. But it certainly would be good to have some successes under the Endangered Species Act so that we don't have to fight the battle protecting the act itself.
One of the old sayings in international conservation, and I've done quite a bit of work in various parts of Asia, is that for conservation to be successful, the local people have to benefit. The local people have to want it. Mm-hmm. They have to get some bennies. And it's really no different in the United States than it is elsewhere. The local people have to accept what's going on. And there are a lot of frustrated people out there right now. And and we've got to find a balance.
Yeah, I think that frustration, I wouldn't call it boiling over, but the congressional delegations of the states of the Northern Rockies have all proposed removing the wolf from the Endangered Species Act. Frankly, I don't think that's going to go anywhere, but it spells out the frustrations and what kind of calls they're getting. I see Ray standing up. We don't have an awful lot of time yet, but if you've got calls or questions, please line up. I've been given authority to yank the chain on anybody trying to make a speech. If you have a question, ask a question. We'll welcome any, but we don't want speech making. Ray, did you have a question?
Is this on? Yeah, I've got a question. The way wolves are executed by the federal government, the wolves that get into trouble because they prey on livestock, it's often done by helicopter, basically professional marksmen that work for the government, and they know where the wolves are because there's radio collars on every pack. So the managers have a tremendous amount of knowledge about where the bad wolves are. And so they just go out and execute them from the air with shotguns or similar methods. And in terms of what that teaches the wolf society, maybe they learn to fear helicopters. I'm not sure what that teaches wolf society. They pass knowledge along to each other. They're a social animal. But when hunters go out, they're killing wolves much differently. And I've always thought they're teaching wolves to avoid people, period. And so my thought for a long time has been the more hunting of wolves we have, the easier they are going to be to manage, because we're teaching them to avoid people. And so they might be less likely to come around ranches. And I just wonder what some of the panelists think about that.
Okay, the question was, does hunting of wolves, since they are pack animals, spread a fear of knowledge among the pack and other animals? Anybody?
I can try to address that. I can be facetious and say dead wolves don't learn anything, but
I think that applies to bears.
Some students too,
because they're not pack animals.
Don't learn anything, but I think that's largely true. But the other thing that happens is that hunters typically, well, we hunters like to think that we go way out in the backcountry. Most hunters are pretty darn close to roads and ranches. Most of the hunting occurs on lowland private ranches and public land, but at lower elevations. And those are areas where wolves get into trouble with livestock. So if they learn, great. But the other thing is you reduce the population there, so you reduce the need for them to have to provide the food to their pups and so forth. So I think it is something that will help overall with the depredation problems. But there are some other issues, as Suzanne brought up. But for the most part, I think it's a good thing in reducing the depredation problems.
Well, don't we have a situation where in some places there's a resident wolf pack that is not preying on livestock, and the fear is that if you kill that pack or disrupt that pack, then another pack is going to move in and not be as well behaved.
We've actually had seen that happen
yeah,
over
I
and
think
over
we
again.
Have
Absolutely,
seen that
positively.
Yeah.
Elaine, did you want to address that?
I think hunting is a good tool because they do become more aware. You call what we call a smart coyote. We'll try to stay away if you are present with your livestock. And I think it's controlled by regions and districts and knowing where populations of wolves are and where those numbers should be for hunting and controlling it by areas rather than just saying we're going to kill, 100 wolves in Montana. It's going to be specific to certain areas where there are impacts.
And just to clarify, too, because I think people often make the mistake of assuming just because we're a wildlife conservation organization that we're anti-hunting, and Defenders is not anti-hunting. We want to see the wolf population managed by the states, but in a responsible manner. And that means that in order to have hunting sustained, you have to have a population that's sustained as well,
exactly.
And not just driven down to the very, very minimum numbers.
Okay, let's get another question.
Hi, I'm Ilsa. I'm an environmental journalist based in Los Angeles. My question is for Elaine, since I don't live in this region. You mentioned land use rules affecting your operations, and I'd just like to hear a little bit more specifically how that is, how it's affecting you, what rules are affecting you.
Okay.
Did everybody hear the question?
Peter, if you would.
She asked for some more specifics on how land use regulations affect Elaine's ranching operation and others by extension.
Okay. Most of the land use regulations are if your ranch has public land, like BLM, Forest Service, state land.
Forest land.
I think I said Forest Service.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you have to live by rules that are established by policy and influence. And it's always influenced by either politics or science. And it's numbers of days that you can graze, where they can water, where you move them, the numbers that you can have. And so as in certain areas, they've reduced the numbers to where it's not economically viable for an operation to run. In our case, in the Forest Service, some of the rules were if we started having predator problems, we needed to move our sheep. And if you've ever been in the backcountry in the subalpine, it's pretty difficult. We had a documentary done about our operation. So if you look at that operation, you can see how difficult it is to move livestock in the backcountry. And they expected us to move to either different places or leave. And we couldn't leave because our ranch was our winter country, so it would have changed our whole operation. It ended up changing our whole operation because we didn't have enough land to run the amount of sheep we did, so we sold our ranch at Big Timber to some rich people who built a million dollar house and bought a ranch up at northern Montana, farther away from beautiful places that people want.
Next question. Could you give your name, please?
Sure, yeah. I'm Tom Morton from the Casper, Wyoming Star Tribune. And so I've covered this somewhat, but there are a lot of folks, as you know, who are opposed. I do have to make frame this, that for a lot of people in Wyoming, ranchers are not wolves eating cattle, sheep, tourists, or whatever is not the issue, or it is tertiary at best. They see this as an part of an all-out attack on their 10th Amendment rights, their way of life, an attack on ranching, hunting, ranching especially on public lands, and a few other things. And the discussions about whether, well, wolves only kill this many sheep compared to coyotes or whatever. That is not their issue. Biodiversity is not their issue. Their issue is a deep, deep belief that they are being attacked, threatened, whatever. This is not just a Tea Party issue. And so my question for those who are pro-wolf introduction is, how do you deal with this issue? Because otherwise, y'all look like you're just from the government, Washington, some environmental organization wanting to take away somebody's way of life. And you can say, well, that's just ridiculous. It is not. So how do you deal with this? Because you're not winning.
Well, I think thank you for that question. I think what he's talking about is a clash of cultures between urban and rural cultures. And it's an interesting idea. Anybody want to hop on that?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Who wants to go first?
The question was probably directed toward me, but the thing about the driving people out of their lifestyles and stuff, that's not what this is about for us. We have done more as a wildlife organization to help ranchers than I think any other organization in this country has. We have contributed not only monetarily through the compensation program, almost $1.4 million since wolves started coming back on their own in 1987 across the border, which was a substantial program for us to be able to maintain. In addition to that, we have done hundreds of projects to help ranchers with making the adjustment to both grizzly bears and wolves. And it's not just ranchers. We're working with landowners as well. The folks that you talked about having the chicken coops, we're working on, and we have put in all kinds of electric fencing around those chicken coops now so that they're not having problems anymore. There are a lot of things we can do to coexist with wildlife. And it runs the full gamut of really practical things like removing dead carcasses of livestock because they're attractants. When that's possible to do, it's not always possible to do. But it is often, and it often sets up a situation where you have wolves coming into an area that they wouldn't otherwise be in if you didn't have that presence of that attractant there for them. So helping remove those things can actually prevent a conflict from occurring. We're in our third year of a project in central Idaho right now. It's called the Wood River Wolf Project. It is in the superhighway of sheep in our state. We have 12,000 sheep that go through our project area every year. And this is an area where we have a high concentration of wolves. It's one of the largest conflict areas in the past where wolves have been killing livestock. And they kill more sheep than they do any other type of livestock. So we chose this area because it was the hardest one to tackle. This is our third year. We've had field crews out there working with the ranching community since June every year, all the way through the end of the grazing season, which ends next week. And this year, we've had one sheep killed by wolves, one. In the project area last year, we had 18 sheep killed by wolves. That was because one night, we didn't have a band protected because we weren't aware that that band was in our project area. And in one night, that's how many were taken because those tools and deterrents weren't there to protect those sheep. And the year before, I think we had one sheep again killed. So over this course of time, it's less than 24, two dozen sheep out of 12,000 that make their way and live 24/7 with wolves in the same vicinity. We can coexist with wolves, and we just have to have means for doing it. So this isn't about driving people out of business. We appreciate and respect the Western culture and the Western way of life. My family came from farmers and ranchers, and my family is still ranching. It's not just about dividing this culture and trying to make us win versus the other. We have to do this together.
Well, I think the frustrations are real, particularly in Wyoming, but a vast left-wing conspiracy. I don't know any left-wingers smart enough to pull it off. Wyoming ships polluted water to Montana. They ship brucellosis to Montana. And
working on CWD.
They're working on chronic waste disease. And Wyoming also has saddled Montana and Idaho with this wolf debate by its stubborn intransigence and refusal to accept anything but a shoot on sight policy for wolves in most of the state.
There are some easy things, and Suzanne is talking about, to reduce the problems, but they're too big. The area is too big. There are too many livestock. You can't have that many people out on the land. There will always be problems with livestock when we have wolves out on the landscape. Mm-hmm. Now, part of your issue, I think, or the issue that you brought up, is that we had an agreement that was signed off on. We're way beyond that, and so an awful lot of people feel betrayed. We agreed to this level, and now it's this level.
I think a lot of people see the goalpost moving ever farther away.
We have to follow the science, too, but with wolves being such good dispersers, we've got much less of an issue than if it was grizzly bears.
I think people tend to hear and remember things that they also want to hear and remember. I've been working
Absolutely.
On this issue for a very long time, and I do remember the conversations early on about the recovery goals. And we were assured that that if we had 10 breeding pairs in each of the three recovery areas that bred successfully for three consecutive years, and that they were linked together, and that they were then tied to the Canadian wolf population, that that would be the recovery goal for wolves in the region. And what happened is that we didn't even achieve that 10 breeding pair in each of the three recovery areas until, 2005, when we had close to, I think it was either between 1,200 and 1,500 wolves in the region. So the basic math that we were under the impression mm-hmm. of 100 in each of these recovery areas was way off. And of course, as we've gone over the decades now, when we were explained that you should have these 10 breeding pairs and then we'll transfer management, it wasn't about setting the cap at 100 wolves. It was setting the cap to turn the process over to the states. And I remember Ed Bangs explaining this to me, because I didn't understand it, that the Endangered Species Act was supposed to be the ambulance that would help bring wolves back because they had been eradicated from our region. But that ambulance was meant to take them to the states, which were the hospital that would eventually totally take over the recovery of that species. So that's what hasn't happened. Our states are under the grip of people, particularly in Idaho and probably in Wyoming as well, that simply don't want wolves. Our state wolf management plan has a preface in it that says we want all wolves removed from the state by any means necessary. That is the beginning of our state wolf management plan. So the politics that are involved in wolf management right now are so extreme that they threaten the overall recovery for wolves in the region.
Okay, I just got the high sign. Dan, you got any thoughts on... I'm sorry, I just got the thing, and we need to wrap this up.
We got concurrent sessions.
Yeah, we've got more. I apologize for not getting to all the questions. Dan, you got any thoughts on where to go from here? I mean, is there a way to get off-centered, a way to diffuse some of this high sentiment?
I don't really think that what we're dealing with concerning wolves today is a whole heck of a lot different than the way we're dealing with an awful lot of issues in society today. It's a lot of people screaming. Yeah. It's a lot of people hollering. It's a lot of people throwing chairs. And nobody threw chairs up here. That's a good thing. I think what we have to do for wolves to be delisted and to move on, declare success, are a couple of things. One is Wyoming still has to develop a management plan that is acceptable. As one of the scientific reviewers of the state recovery plans, I didn't think Wyoming's was very far off, but it wasn't going to succeed as written. And I think Wyoming can do that. Secondly, I think people have to stop arguing their positions and start talking more about what their concerns are. It's not delist wolves, reduce wolf populations. It's I want to continue to be able to earn a living on my ranch. I want to continue to be able to work outside. I want to feel safe when I'm outside. I want to be sure that wolves will remain on the landscape. We got to start thinking about what their concerns are, discuss what those concerns are, and let's move on, because, folks, there are proposals out there right now to weaken the Endangered Species Act. That could be the worst thing that ever happens to wildlife on this continent. That is a strong piece of legislation. It's a good piece of legislation. It can work very well. We might lose it. So let's get together and figure this thing out, move forward, spend some of the $1 million that we're spending on wolves every year on species that hardly anybody even knows about. They're getting $0 for their recovery because all of the money is being spent on a couple of high-profile species like wolves, grizzly bears, and condors, while many of these others are falling off the edge. So as you report on this issue, I would encourage you folks to start talking to people who have some ideas for solutions, and let's get there sooner rather than later.
I know the other panelists would all have good summations, but that was a great summation, and I'd like to end it there if I could. Thank you very much for a great panel.